I'd like to begin with a few words of dedication before we go into the next part, just to give us a context to start with. And it's appropriate we start right on time. You'll be learning about some of Ralph Cook's students today and onwards, and one of them who this class is inspired by his teachings was also very precise to start on time. So this is a good siman for that, that we can just do that spontaneously and easily. So thank you so much for being here. And I'd like to, since everybody knows each other, and I know the Ornsteins, so I feel like I know everybody here somehow, that we have a very good friend who I studied Rav Cook many times with, and we celebrated many times with. Already, this is Yoram Getzler Zal, who passed away Purim, and a friend of our, very close friend of many of us, and we're really suddenly, and it's very sad. And he was a great friend in my own study of Rav Cook. We were studying together already in the 80s in Yerushalayim. We had a study group, a Chaburah, that Yoram and Simcha and other friends would come every single week, or we'd go to their Moshav Aminadav and celebrate in the hills of Yerushalayim. And he passed away. And so to the Aliyat Neshama of Yoram Ben Yaakov Bela Bela Miriam Zichrono Levracha. And also in the words are going to be of Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. And I'd like to begin our time with his words rather than mine. And he passed away in 1935, and is the reason we're here. And he wrote these words in the early 1900s. If you have a heart, and in your heart red blood is flowing that has not been poisoned by the toxins of despair, and if our hearts are covered, uncircumcised, and beauty holds no spell, then existence whispers to me, away from me, away. To you I am closed, locked, forbidden. Sua meni sua, meni necha, asua. Vedor yakum v'chai, v'yashir v'yofi v'chaim, v'edna blida yinak mital shamayim. And a generation will awaken and come to life and sing to beauty and to life and draw unending delight from the dew of heaven. Mihadar Karmel v'Sharon Shifat v'Zeh Ahavaya Takshiv Ozen Am Chai. From the vistas of the Carmel and the valleys of the Sharon will flow the wealth of life's secrets to be heard by the ears of a people alive. Umi Eden Shira ve'efi chayim or kodesh yimaleh. And from the Eden, the delight of her song and the beauty of her life, a holy light will fill all. Vahavaya kula lo tedovev, and all existence will murmur lovingly to us. Echiri, arein lecha, lach, moteret, my beloved, I am yours. All existence whispers to me in silence. I have life to offer. Take, please take. Tilchash li sod, ahavaya kula. Ta'im li yesh. Kach. Na. Kach.
Thank you for allowing me to start with that. So my name is Yitzchak, and I want to say how sweet it is because I remember one of the last times being at your house in the New York countryside, state of New York countryside, and we cooked with Eliza Chava and had a whole evening. So we've studied Rav Kook before in other conferences, so it's a delight to be here in Tel Aviv. It's one thing studying Rav Kook in the countryside in New York State. In Tel Aviv, it's like there's so many more dimensions. So it's my pleasure, really, to be introduce those of you that don't know that much and continue to deepen everybody's familiarity with the teachings of Avraham Yitzchak of Kohen Kuk. And I'll give you, we'll start, I guess, with the basic headlines. Born in 1865, should I move that or something? Or that's okay. Born in 1865 in Gryaz, Lithuania. And the way when I... Let me step back a little bit from 1865. Imagine one of the things I do is in Jerusalem. I haven't been in Tel Aviv for quite a while. In Jerusalem, I have the privilege of being and working and bringing groups to Rav Kook's house in Jerusalem. We can visit his house in Yafo as a field trip one time, but he came to Jerusalem and has a house there which is a very special place. And when groups are there, I say to them, we have to look in context of history to understand Rav Kook. And the... As I go back, we still look at the shelves. The Jewish history from the point of the exile. We're told one of the last things Moses tells us in Sefer Dvarim, he says, after you'll go through the experience of all the blessings and curses, a remnant, or she'erit, another word, will come back and you will inherit the land of your ancestors and you'll flourish there even more. So that's the overarching vision. The Mekubalim taught us through the Nevi'ah, they went
through to the Mekubalim, and written in Sefer Zohar. In Sefer Zohar we say the process of return will experience a particular strengthening at the point of 5,000. This is the Zohar's language. At the point of 5,000, the Vav will rise out of the dust, and in a 1,000-year process connect the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey, bringing back the divine name and bringing history to its evolved and intended completion. And that corresponds to the year 1240. That's when the Zohar was also published, released. The Tabak came out around then. And who was the first person then to return from the Galut with this teaching resonating in their ear? Anybody else? Take a guess. Who was the first person from after 1240 that we have a historical record of that came to Israel from outside Israel? He was born in Jerusalem in 1500s. The Ramban was in his late 60s. 1269, he comes to Israel as an old man. He finds two Jews in the old city, and he sets up a synagogue. Today, that's it.
God, there's hundreds of people daily on Shabbat. You must reach your thousands.
Right above it is, of course, the great synagogue, so there's place for everybody. But, and then it started. The next teacher in that link is, of course, the Ari. 300 years later, he's born in Jerusalem, not far from the Ramban synagogue. If you go to Jerusalem, see the room where he was. And then his story is he goes as a young man to the Nile, and his uncle has a yeshiva in that area, Alexandria, but he spends all his time on the River Nile meditating on the Zohar. And from the understandings he got, he went to Tzfat and taught them for 2 years, passed away, and then things seeded extraordinary things. But in a nutshell, there's two things that he taught. One is the entire Lurianic Kabbalah, the three-dimension, five-dimension, ten-dimension tree of life, which was before more static. He suddenly showed how it's all psychedelic, really. But also, less known, and more, and also very true, he said, for the Ge'ula to happen, itorarut milamata mevi itorarut milamala, awakening below brings awakening from above, therefore we have to start returning to Israel. And the first people that were back with that teaching, there were always small groups of people in Yehuda, possibly in different ones, but then what happened was the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon were students of the Ari, and they started sending people back, particularly the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon in the late 1600s, he almost came here and he passed away, but right in the late 1700s, and he passed away, but the first his first generation of students, in 1808, a group of 70 Vilna Gaonites came here. And why 70? The resignation? The 70 that went down to Mitzrayim. This is the 70 that are returning to Israel. This is all documented. I'm not making this up. It's all written in, I'll show you the book later. And 70 come back, and then they set up a Beit Midrash in 1812, according to the Vilna Gaon's teaching, that a strong day when the Klipa doesn't have any influence on the day, the Sirah, is the 20th day of the counting of the Omer. And so they instituted in 1812 the Beit Midrash on Eliyahu Island, the old city of Tzfat, in 1812. And then in the 1850s, when Jews could first build outside of the old city, Montefiore built the windmill, Sephardim built by the American Embassy, and then in 1869, The Vilna Gaon students and families, seven families, Nachlat Shiva, the third neighborhood in Yerushalayim. I imagine most people know, have been there.
That was established, and the Beit Midrash there was inaugurated on the 20th day of the counting of Omer, 1869.
Because the Vilna Gaon's Kabbalistic teachings to them were that. Anybody know what day, the 20th day of the counting of the Omer is?
Tick, tick, tick. 1-15. It's the 5th of Iyar. Yom HaTzma'ut in 1948 is the 20th day of the counting of the Omer.
Coincidence? But interesting. Interesting. So in that Shalshelet, we're going back, so then we were at the Ari in the 1500s, the students of the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon. And if any, how many people are familiar? You've been doing Zohar here for a while now. And Zohar taught here 2 courses ago, so that's the Mashiach Ben Yosef and Mashiach Ben Yavi. People know about that?
Yeah.
All right, so I won't go into it now, but we will go into it. But there's a double step process, the Messianic process, according to the Zohar and so on, and it's basically that first there comes the movement of Yosef, which is to build the infrastructure, and he passes away, he's killed tragically, and then comes Mashiach ben David, and that's forever. And so Vilna Gaon said the beginnings of the land, building the land, and all that activity which he directed to is that activity. And the gematria of the Vilna Gaon's name is equivalent to Mashiach ben Yosef, and so on and so forth. So he really moved that trigger along. And then, all of that was so then, the next person in that shalshelet is Rav Kook, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Kook, born 1865 in Griev, Lithuania. His father was from the students of the school of the Vilna Gaon of that world, as well as being a Kohen. His mother was a Chabadnik. Her father was a close chassid of the Tzemach Tzedek. And so he was an integration of chassidut and mitznagdim and all that. Early on recognized as an extraordinary soul, mentored by the Chafetz Chaim, to be a teacher and a leader of Israel. And he was one of the first ones to start speaking Hebrew already in like school and cheder. He was, the story's told, you know, during break at cheder, they would walk around the class and everybody, he would lead everybody, put on their backpacks. You know, where are we going? Let's Israel! And he would, you know, that would be the game. He would lead people in down. He was one of the first ones to speak Hebrew in the Volozhin Yeshiva when he came as 17, 18 years old and was the most extraordinary student the Volozhin Yeshiva ever had in its history. He did 60, 70 pages of Gemara each day. He was the only one who was allowed to wear tefillin and talit all day, because he did it, because it was like on a very high level. The other superstar students asked the Rosh Yeshiva, they said, no way, Jose. Atem kulchem tzadikim, aval hu tzadik v'yashar. Everybody is righteous, but he is righteous v'yashar, connected. And so he can keep the tefillin on all day. And then mentored as in the age of 23, sent out by the Prophet Tzad to be a community rabbi. Got married, and I'll tell you the family story eventually. You'll read about it if you're interested. Then, in 1904, when he was about 30 years old, 25, a rich man in Europe said, you know what, I'll send you to Israel. And he was ready to go, but I think it was his father-in-law who advised him, no, go when you're invited to be a rabbi in Israel. He listened to him, and when he was 39 years old, he was invited to be the chief rabbi of Yafo. And he arrived in the 28th day of Iyar, 1904. And they celebrated that as their family holiday, the Cook family holiday. from that year on. It's, you can read about it in letters and so forth. And everything he did from that point on until he passed away in 1935 was dedicated and influential in the most extraordinary ways in seeing and moving along Israel, the physical and spiritual, intellectual, emotional, inspirational Israel. And it's really, there's so many more details, and if I start, I'll never stop, so I'll really have to just, you know, just a little bit at a time, because there's so much. There's a book called An Angel Among Men, which I really recommend, to if you want to read all about that book from Bassem Kavaz. But for us, we're going to spend most of our time learning Baruch from his own words. And there's going to be handouts. It's not a good time to give them out. First of all, there's an article I wrote a few years ago in Tikkun magazine, Rav Kook, Master of the Lights, which will serve to amplify some of what I've been introducing. And feel free to read it, you know, at home. It's not for reading in the class, but reading at home. Again, we'll pass the source sheets for this evening's session, and I'll tell you a little bit about the structure of our time together. My expectation is that we'll try to use our time together in to come into three pieces, so to speak. It's important in learning a book, especially at the beginning, I think it's helpful to have a frame so that, you know, to sort of take things on, but because his writing and his thinking is so extraordinary, it's like a vast, finite, infinite ocean of inspiration and thought. And you can dip anywhere and find tremendous light. But it's also helpful to have a context. So the first third of our time together, I'm going to do two different contexts. One that, based on the first piece we're going to do, which I'll explain, and we'll spend the first third on that particular frame. The second, we'll look at Rav Kook from the perspective of his main student, Rav David Cohen, the Rav Nazir, and then Zatzal, and then the third section, we'll open it up and just to discussion and what we want to be interested in and of ourselves. But it's... any questions, comments at this point? נכון, אנחנו אני מקורים בעברית ומתרגמים לאנגלית. What? It's because his
he don't read Hebrew very well.
You know, oh yes, okay. So that actually, let me tell you, there's not that much of this translated, and if we limit ourselves to what's translated, it's not good. But there is a. If somebody, I didn't feel right asking the Alma to also translate this source book. It's from an English book. So if the class, or people in class want to photocopy, then some of the pieces we'll be doing, for example, the one we're doing now, is translated in it. And if you want to take it upon, you know, to organize a photocopying of these, and this one has some very important essays of Rav Kook that are... super duper worth reading.
It's all English.
From the Boxer book. It's all English. So if somebody, but I wouldn't do that. Don't do it now.
No, that's not
going to give
it.
It's not too much.
Need it?
I don't need it. Not now. But okay. So you will have whatever English there. But the way we
But what we're going to do is actually read these Greek and follow along and translate everything. Sometimes we'll skip things, and that's how we'll answer it. But let's begin. I guess I'll wait for Steve. And
can I ask a question?
Sure.
Can you say again what it was about the 28th day of the Omer?
Ah, well, there's two things. I didn't finish. Yeah. The 20th day of Omer has always been, since the counting of the calendar, the 5th day of Iyar. The 5th day of Iyar in 1948 was May 14th, but that became now Israel's Independence Day. So, and the day that Rav Kook first, I'm not sure if I may finish this thought, when Rav Kook first arrived in 1904, the 28th of Iyar, that is the third day of the Six-Day War. That's the day that everyone celebrates Yom Yerushalayim. The anniversary of the day where the first step foot in the land of Israel. So we're really talking, we have different attitudes towards that, but as a unabashed chassid of the teachings of Rav Kook, tzadik gozer l'kadosh baruch hu mekayem l'tah.
Why was the 20th auspicious? There was a reason.
The 20th day of the
Sphira. Something in the Sphira of the...
Well, the teaching that the 20th day of the Sphira of Omer was auspicious is the Vilna Gaon gave that teaching.
It wasn't based on some particular...
He has Kabbalistic, language to explain it, but it doesn't mean much to me. But the fact that day is the day that the Klippa doesn't have shlita, control over the thing...
That's the 20th?
28th, those are two different days. The 20th day of the counting of the Omer is the 5th day of Iyar.
Right.
The 28th day of Iyar is like the...
It's actually similar.
It's a different day in the counting of the Omer. But it's the anniversary of the day that Rav Kook first stepped foot into Israel. That was a day. And there's also an allusion... Anyways, the Vilna Gaon is amazing. I'll just tell you more. It's also an appropriate time. It's interesting, we're reading here sort of that I sent digitally. We'll have to correct a few letters as we read. But what we'll be reading from are from Rav Kook's writings. And Rav Kook's writings began as notebooks.
Is that a real notebook?
Well, a photo facsimile.
Ah, they made a copy.
And it's the original size of some of them. The small ones that you can see today. We'll pass it around. And then he put them into notebooks, full notebooks, which he gave his student. And they were just notebooks and notebooks of his writings and thoughts. This is from 1904 to 1907, 1908, this particular volume. And then his student, the Nazir, I'll tell you more about, put them, they were the first editions that he had. He put them into a, separated them piece by piece and gave them the titles and the whole context. And this came out, Rav Kook saw the galleys of the first two volumes of this on his deathbed in Rosh Chodesh Elul, 1935, and he cried, knowing that his teachings, his writings are going to go out to the world, to the children of Israel. He passed away 3 days later, the Gimel Elul. He arrived in Yerushalayim in 1919, Gimel Elul. And he passed away on Gimel Elul in 1935. He was born in Elul, the 16th of Elul, and all his writings are about Elul, Tshuva, the month of Tshuva, and the 6 months before Tishrei, and it's really, he brought the, my understanding was that the Vilna Gaon's teachings about the infrastructure, Mashiach ben Yosef, and that was when Rav Kook came, Herzl died. Herzl died about 2 months after Rav Kook passed away.
And after Rav Kook passed away, or
when Rav Kook arrived in Yafo, Herzl in Europe, Theodor Herzl passed away about 2 months later.
In
1904, and Rav Kook was invited to address the Shloshim, and it was one of his first major addresses. And the first time that also the rabbis in Yerushalayim saw that, this is like, is he going to go and talk to the Chilonim Zionists? And of course he did.
But what, and that, what he said though is written, it's fascinating, it's called Hesped Yerushalayim, the Eulogy for Yerushalayim. And basically what it is, it's an analysis of what I've been talking about, Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David, an expansion of it, implying, he didn't mention Herzl by name, but implying that which Herzl works towards, create the land, the infrastructure, and begin that whole process, is all the activity of Mashiach ben Yosef. And so implying that Herzl, not that Herzl specifically is Mashiach ben Yosef, but that historical process is part of it. And my understanding is anyway, the arrival of Rav Kook in Israel was the fulfillment of that Medrash at a time where the Mashiach ben David process will come, and Rav Kook is very much the light of that process.
So the Zionist movement was aware of Rav Kook's teachings.
They weren't aware of it. They invited him because he was the chief rabbi.
Not because they were aware of his teachings.
Not per se. I don't know. Some of the stuff is just starting to get published. They wouldn't have read that stuff. He started to publish. Once he arrived in Yafo, one of the first things that came out is a little pamphlet called Hador, The Generation. And it's extraordinary. If you have time, you can look at parts of it. And it basically...
Why is that significant? Why is Hador significant?
Because when you look at it, it's one of his clearest statements of what's happening now in history. And he says, we have to understand, and this I'm in my own words, that what's happening in front of us, and you see that the young and the rebellious and the idealistic, non-religious, what they're doing is expressing the highest ideals and helping bring things forward at a much higher level, and we need to bring them spirit with love, not with, kovesh them, that's the word he used, that they can just be, obedient to religion. Mm-hmm. That model is no longer the model, this is a new generation. And he continues on and on.
That's pretty radical.
Yeah, that was only in 1906.
Yeah, I'm curious about the relationship between the Jews who came to Jaffa, or came through Jaffa, and because there was this whole movement of the Zionist movement already had people settling the country in those days, and the question was if there was some kind of a dialogue, if he was aware, he was obviously aware that they were coming, were they aware what he was writing, what he was teaching?
Once he arrived, people became aware, and all the intellectuals went to hang out with him, and they were discussing, and got involved, and his writings were published in the newspapers, and all that, so he became deeply involved.
How long was he in Yafo?
From 1904 to 1914. What happened was, in 1914, he was invited to address the meeting, perhaps the inaugural meeting of the Agudat Israel, maybe it was their second meeting, and also to join the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah of the Torah, the Torah sages of Europe and so on. And he didn't really want to leave Israel, but understanding that this was his opportunity to communicate to the rabbis of Europe, that his koach shichnua, his clarity and ability to convince was so powerful that he may have had some influence on their attitudes towards what was going on in Israel, and start encouraging and supporting it rather than blocking it. And by that time, there were already rumors about him. His major issue already in 1910, he stood for the rights of having the Shmita observed against the elder rabbi Yitzchak the Litvaz, who was in the 60s under the Hemalach authority in the land of Israel. In those issues, Rav Kook, as the chief rabbi Yafo in the settlements, insisted that they used the heter that they used in the 1890s again. It's the seventh year in 1909. And he created the chief rabbinate once he was in Yerushalayim, but he began the process And what he was doing quite importantly is that from that point, the first thing that he did, he ensured that mitzvot of the land of Israel were embedded, so that whatever we grew in the land of Israel would have truma and meiser and all that stuff, so that we could get the blessing from it. Mm-hmm. And that's what he instituted, basically. He was the rabbi that set up that system. So, 1914, but the meeting never happened, unfortunately.
He
went to Europe. It was, which broke out in 1914 on the Hebrew day Tisha B'Av.
Oh my goodness.
And Arya Levine, who was already one of Rav Kook's Hasidim, the Tzaddik of Jerusalem, said, you know, when the light gets too strong, Amalek comes in to disturb it. And World War I broke out rather than Rav Kook ever having a chance to address the rabbis. He went to Switzerland in refuge for a year and a half, wrote his most Kabbalistic writings, and then he was invited to be a rabbi in London, arrived in London early 1917, and was hugely influential on the Balfour Declaration. It's fair to say, when I fill in the history at some later point, if he wasn't there, the Balfour Declaration would not have come to be. Okay, that's a little bit known of history that people don't know, but it's amazing. It's all about him. Comes after the war, comes back to Israel, is invited to be the chief rabbi of Jerusalem in 1919, accepts and creates the chief rabbinate of Israel in 1921, and is the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi, along with Meir Uziel Zatzal, the chief Sephardi chief rabbi, and until 1935, when he passed away at the age of 70 of cancer. And some people say he got weakened in 1929, when he heard about the pogroms in Hebron, and he fainted with Shabbat in his home in the Beis Medrash, because he felt responsible. He had brought that yeshiva there in the mid-1920s, encouraging Slobodka to come to Hebron. And he felt very responsible, because he began to age when he started mourning that. So, profoundly involved. To the extent that Israel's 60th anniversary, Gesher in Yediot Ahronot did a poll, who's the person most influential in shaping the modern state of Israel? Number four was Herzl. Number three was right invoked, no validity, Lubavitch already. Number two was Ben-Gurion, and number one was Rav Kook. And so, I just have forgotten the example. They're the Hasidim, they use the internet. Though Rav Kook had a profound relationship with Chabad, and the Friedrich Rebbe, the Rebbe's father-in-law, the Rebbe before, came and visited Rav Kook on his way to America in 1929, and they had a meeting. Here in Israel, he met Rav Kook at his house Friday afternoon. What's in Shabbat, Rav Kook went to visit him in my pet theory is, and Lubavitch never had anything to do with Israel after that until later, when the 70s, 80s, it started. My understanding is that he made a decision, an agreement with the Rebbe there, that Rebbe would go and take care of world Jewry, and Rav Kook is going to focus in on Israel. And it was so, you know, reasonable. Okay. So let's begin now. Usually we'll start, we'll read more, but it's good to have context. So let's begin. Follow me.
By the way, all the English, the whole two folders of English translations, everybody will have them next week. They'll make copies.
But, like I say, the pieces I'm choosing, I can't limit to just the ones that are translated, because that wouldn't be fair to the material. Let's begin. This piece is called Shir Merubah, the fourfold song. The Zohar says, Yudkei Vavkei. This is the introduction, but it's from the first page. Yudkei Vavkei, Shir Merubah, fourfold song. Yud, Yudhei, Yudhei Vav, Yudhei Vavkei.
1, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. That's how from the 1, the tree of life comes forth, right? 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 is 10. And so you have the expansion of the divine name, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, a fourfold song. That's what the Zohar says. Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, Shir Merubah. Rav Kook one day, in Notebook Zion, this could have even been during the First World War, around that time, wrote this. Yeshehu Shar Shirat Nafsho. There is the person that sings the song of their own nefesh, their own being. Ubenafsho hu motze et hakol, et melo hasipuk haruchani bemilu'o. And in himself, he finds everything. She finds everything. The full spiritual satisfaction. Veyesh, shehu shar shirat nafsho, shirat ha'uma. And then there is the one who sings the song of his people, the nation. Yotzehu mitoch ma'agal shel nafsho ha'pratit. He emerges from the circle of his individual self, she'eno motze ota meruchevet kera'ui, because he doesn't find it of sufficient breadth, ve'lo meyushevet yeshuv ideali, and without an idealistic basis. Sho'ef lemeromei oz, it's not enough for me just to think about myself. What am I doing in the world? Sho'ef lemeromei oz, he aspires for towards the heights. Who mitdabek be'ahava adina im klaluta shel Knesset Israel, and cleaves with a refined light love with the entirety of Knesset Israel. Knesset Israel has got all sorts of Kabbalistic allusions as the entire Israel, spiritually and materially. You know, he could use Am Israel, he could use just Israel. Knesset Israel has lots of resonances. The Iman with Israel, who shar et shireya, he sings her song, Meitzar betzaroteya, feels grieved in her tzarot, is meitzar, is constricted in her tzarot, v'mishta'asheya betikvoteya, and rejoices and delights in her hopes, tikvot, hoge deot elyonot v'tehorot, and he thinks pure and high thoughts al avra v'al atida, on its past and its future. Yeah, we become, you know, we study history, the Jewish history, and all of that. וחוקר באהבה ובחכמת לב את תוכן רוחה הפנימית, and he investigates with love and wisdom of heart her inner spiritual content, all of Israel, right? And this is a level, and this is also a level that we each have simultaneously, right? It's not to see there's one of those and one of those. It's ultimately we each have all of these. Each one of us, perhaps one is stronger than the other, and of course there's a tendency in Israel to stop at this one, perhaps. But being a, you know, a religious Jew is, you know, all about Israel, 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 and but it doesn't go, it goes on. Veyesh asher, here's where there's a typo, od titrachev nafsho, and still will expand your being, ad sheyotze v'mitpashet, there's another missing letter, until you emerge and expand me'al gvul Israel, beyond the boundary of Israel. Lashir et shirat ha'adam, to sing the song of humankind, of the human. Ruchoh holech v'mitrachev, your spirit grows and expands the Gaon Klaluta Adam into the genius and the power. And if somebody has a better, and certain words, feel free to, you know, if there's, I imagine some people here, anyways, I'm not going to ask now, but if you want to give another translation for a certain word, Gaon, I'm not going to, it's a hard word, I don't know how to translate that exactly, but in the genius of her, you go into Gaon Klalut Adam, into the, it's like universalism, but about humans, you know, human universalism, the Hod Tzamo and the splendor of the divine image of each human being. Shoef el tu'udato ha-klalit, he aspires for its universal destiny to come forth, of, you know, all human beings living well, and you know, Bill Gates. V'metzapeh lehishtamuto ha-elyona, he looks forward to its higher completion of all humankind. U'mimikor chaim zeh, who shoev et klalut hegyonotav v'mechkarav, and it's from this source of life that one draws all their thoughts, higayon, ideas and investigations, sheifotav v'chizyonotav, its aspirations and visions. Right, we all have a universal aspect. The Jews, it's particularly strong, and part of the integration, Rav Cook, and we'll talk about this also next week, but he says that it's a funny paradox. He says, in Orot particularly, that we find that the very depths of Israel, what Israel is about, is universalism. That's what being Israel is actually about. It's a fulfillment of it. Well, let's go on. He'll actually, in this case, he says it. Let's just go on. Ve'yesh asher od mizeh, and yet there is that part of us that beyond this, lemala, higher, berochav yitnaseh, expands broadly, rises broadly, ad shemit ached im kol hayekum kulo, until we unite with all of existence. Im kol habriyot, ve'im kol ha'olamim, with all the creatures, with all the worlds, ve'im kulam, omer shira, and with all of them, he sings a song. Right? This is like the cosmos, Carl Sagan. It's like really being with the entire cosmos and singing the song of the cosmos. Zehu ha'osek v'perek shira b'chol yom shemuftach lo shehu ben ha'olam haba. There's a midrash that says, it's in the Gemara, that somebody who says the verse of song, of shirat, a verse of song every day, he's guaranteed he'll be in olam haba. So that's why they have the ashrei in the sidur. That's the designated one. If you say ashrei, you got it, you're covered. And I remember once when I was, you know, like the Siddur was getting lots of different relationships with the Siddur, but once I really wanted to know, what's the minimum? Mm-hmm. And so Pesuket Yizrima is Baruch Shamar, Ashrei, and the end. It's the only one you need to say in Ashrei and you get the thing. But here we're talking about singing, you know, the cosmic song. And that's, once you're in that consciousness, it's guaranteed that you'll be in the world to come. Ve'yesh. And so far, so we see here the four levels, right? The song of the self, the song of the nation, the song of humankind, the song of the cosmos. But then, even in the divine name, there's the fifth level, the tip of the yud, the kotz shel yud, which everything emerges out of. And everything is in there and expands, and in a sense he resonates with that by in this level. Ve'yesh asher ole im kol hashirim halalu beyachad be'aguda achat, and then there is the one who rises with all these songs together in one collection. V'kulam notnim et koloteim, and they all, each one of them, give, lend their voices. Kulam yachad man'imim et zimreim, all together they join their melodies. Na'im, right? Their zemer. V'toch ze noten lished v'chaim, I think. There's another typo there. And this, to this one, gives vitality and life. Kol sason v'kol simcha, kol tzahala v'kol rina, kol chedva v'kol kedusha. Songs of sason, sassy songs of joy. Kol simcha, songs of joy, shemacha, that erase everything else. Simcha lashon shemacha. Kol tzahala v'kol rina, jubilation, songs of song. Chedva v'kedusha, delight, pleasure, holiness. Shirat ha-nefesh, shirat ha-umah, shirat ha-adam, shirat ha-olam. The song of the soul, the song of our people, the song of humankind, the song of the world. Kulan yachad mitmazgot bekirbo bechol et uvechol sha'a. They all together blend together in our being at every moment, at every instant. Of the one who is singing, the person, the being who is the realized being. V'hatmimut hazot, tmimut, and this full ishtam, full completion, b'milua, in its fullness, ola hi li'ot shirat kodesh, this rises to be a holy song, shirat el, the song of God, Shirat Israel. This is the song of Israel. Ba'otzem uzah v'tifarta, and its strength of its power and beauty. Ba'otzem amita v'godla, and its essence and its basic truth and greatness. Israel Shir El. Right? You see that? You move the Yud in Israel one letter to the left, and the name is transmuted. Israel, Shir El, Shir Pashut, Shir Kafur, Shir Meshulash, Shir Meruba, a simple song, a twofold song, a threefold song, a fourfold song. Shir Hashirim, Asher LeShlomo, LeMelech SheHashalom Shelo, the song of songs of Shlomo, the sovereign, with whom is wholeness and peace. Israel Shir El, Shir Pashut, Shir Kaful, Shir Meshulash, Shir Meruba, Shir Hashirim, Asher LeShlomo, LeMelech, SheHashalom Shelo. I mean, one can't...
What is he trying to teach? Liz's question.
In this particular one, who would like to offer a thought about that?
He wanted to understand what he has to offer.
Why is it important to us right now, today?
So how does this piece respond to that?
This isn't the first time I've heard this, but I've thought about it in terms of like a leadership hierarchy, like a person has to understand themselves and go deep in themselves in order to relate to the nation, and go deep into the nation in order to relate to humankind, and then go deep into understanding humankind or understand the cosmos. But there's like a progression of understanding that a person can work to achieve that I think he's suggesting. That's a process.
Yes.
Or is it possible that there are different levels, different kinds of people, different approaches?
Yes, they are. They can be. He does seem to say quite directly, though, that our goal, though, is to integrate them all. Is to understand that to be Israel means singing the song of God, and the song of God is all of those songs. And we're not really at our
solar city difference.
Yachad man imim et zimreim. They harmonize their melody, yes, very much. It's about being a whole being, and being a whole being is please.
I have a question. question more than a comment. Is this really considered a departure from what has been taught up until the time he wrote it? Because I'm suggesting that it might be, because this whole thing about universalism and then above that, I mean, that seems like something not necessarily that you would associate with teachings of Jewish thinkers.
Yes, and my best understanding of the Torah is that this is a more accurate reflection of the Torah's deepest teachings, and that we can find the seeds of this clearly stated in many places, but that the flow of history, and what happened is we got historically limited and began to, you know, see that, you know, all of that stuff. But, you know, for good reason, nobody, you know, we were like, nobody want, you know, the history. He has, in one of the essays that I've been passing on, he says it specifically. History has made us concerned about that, but we have to understand this is an aberration. We're here to fulfill Avraham's destiny, and Avraham was universalist. Avraham was not speaking to the Jewish people. And then he has another place where he says, Yetziat Mitzrayim was leaving Egypt in order to create ourselves. The next Geulah will be going into the world as Israel, and really bringing everything Israel has to offer to the world. But it's a departure from a certain strand, the whole Galut Judaism and all of that, and that chauvinistic, that sort of, you know, paranoid Judaism. But I think it's a self-correction on the path to enlightenment. The true like the Torah's life, because, you know, the Torah is much larger than parochialism. Mm-hmm. And he speaks in those terms. Okay. And the other way it's a departure of this is that nobody has ever said it quite so poetically. Right? Here's a beautiful, and the first piece I read you he wrote as a poem. Mm-hmm. Like he wrote poetry, and when Bialik would see his poetry, Bialik was considered, you know, the poet of Israel, and they were close. And Bialik was like the Tel Aviv of Cook in many ways, and that he was in the state. And he said, Bialik, you're a genius, he would talk, until it was with Rav Kook. He would ask Rav Kook a question, and then he would just listen. He would ask another question, and he would just absorb. And then when he saw Rav Kook's poetry, he said, my God, or whatever he said, I spend a month on every bite, for every verse. I change, I erase. The thing was just a flow. Mm-hmm. And it was. And his writing, the piece we just read, for example, here's the left. You can just see, this is a facsimile from his notebooks. I can pass this around as well. But you can just see, just writing. Nothing crossed out. And so it was in a constant state of illumination and inspiration, and a tremendous gift to us. We have this river of I call it Harchavat Torah HaTorah, the expansion of the Torah, or expressing the most broadest Torah that's yet been expressed by a human being. I don't think it's unfair to say that. Okay. So now, this is the first context, because we're here for five sessions. I want to use this as a bit of a frame, because he names these four levels. Mm-hmm. And I want to focus in on each of them, because really the teaching is to be a whole human being. I mean, somebody could do make a zillion dollars new aging Rav Kook, Zatzal, because in this language he's really talking all of those languages, to be a whole human being, to be a complete human being, Maslow, all of those things are in here. You have to be, you can't just be one dimensional, you have to recognize all parts of yourself. You have to honor your universal being. You have to honor that part of us that cares about the non-Jews. You can't, you know, it's not incomplete unless we're really
individual or a nation.
Well, it's here. Both.
The Yesh.
Both.
Referring to types of.
Well, these are human beings. The Yesh is a person. There is the person. There is so literally here is very much on that human level. But I think it's in a start we have to understand that the nation, they're all mirrors of each other. So our nation to be whole also has to honor each of those parts of itself. And Israel's doing it in many ways. It's been awesome. It's, you know, for me it's a blessing. Being in Yerushalayim, you see a certain frame and you forget about, you know, what's really happening in Israel. And coming here in Tel Aviv, it's like so beautiful to watch it unfold. And I say, oh yeah, that's why Israel is making me so great, because what's going on here in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, you know, nobody does anything but talk or study, you know, in Jerusalem, right? But, you know, there's nobody doing much. But here, you come in the vibrancy, and you see there's a serious everything going on here, serious business, serious everything. All right, so since our time is fairly, we're going to have to condense. I'm going to have to So the first piece is connected to the thought where he says, Yeshu shar shirat nafsho. There is, at least I'll move a little bit closer. And also, can we arrange somehow to be, the Jewish table is like one table, somehow this seems, but I'm glad I found my glasses, so it's now, I feel like I'm, you know, clear with everybody. So we'll do that next time. But the first piece, Yeshu shar rivat nafsho, there is that, the part of us that sings the song of our own being. In our own beings we find everything, our full spiritual satisfaction. The next piece is headed by Shirat Nafsho. It's found in Shmonek Vatsim, the eight notebooks, notebook Dalit, entry Vav, that's what that stands for. And the Shmonek Vatsim were not available to us in their entirety until the 1990s. Before that, we only had the four volumes of The Lights of Holiness that the Rav Nazir put out. But there we find him saying, Dalit would be written around 1910, 1912, somewhere before the First World War, probably. Kol Adam Tzarich Ladat. Each person needs to know, each of us, Shekarui hu la'avod al pi ofen ha'kara, that you are called to serve, to do your work according to your own recognition, the hargasha hamiyuchad shelo, the feeling that is uniquely yours. Al pi shoresh nishmato, according to the source of your soul. Ube'olam zeh, and in this world, ha'kolel olamim ein sfurot, which contains, includes, countless other worlds, yimtza et otzer chayav, you will find the treasure of your life. Each of us has to know that we're called on to serve on the basis of our distinctive understanding, conception, feeling, according to the prompting of our own soul, and it's in that world, in the world of our unique soul, we'll find the treasure of our life. Al yibalbeluhu tochanim shotfim el tocho me'olamot zarim. Don't get mebulbal, Tower of Babel, confused by contents that flow into you from strange worlds. Olamim zarim, right? Avodah zara is idol worship. She'eino koltam kehogan, that you can't absorb them. You can't do klita.
Right? In Israel, klita works, it works, but these are things you can't do klita to. Einam kultam kehogan, you don't absorb them properly. Shino mukshar le'agdam yafeh betzura chaim shelo, that you're not able to eged, to collect them nicely in the treasure of your life. Right? It's like making a child that wants to play piano all day learn something completely opposite. And so on, it's just not going to work. These worlds, these other worlds from the outside, they'll find their repair in their place. With those people who are able to build them and perfect them. The word shichlul is a beautiful word. Perfection is sheklal. The more something is whole, the more something is whole, the more it's perfect. Shichlul, by definition, means making whole. Perfecting is shekol, shekolel kol, shechlul. Aval, hu tzarich ich, we need lerakez et chayav be'olamatav hu. We need to focus our lives in our worlds. Be'olamot hapnimiim shelo, in your inner worlds. Sheheim lo mekifim kol, that they for you include everything. Mlo'im kol, are filled of everything, v'mekifim et hakol, and surround, embrace, include everything. And here he quotes the Mishnah Sanhedrin, Mishnah 4, number 5. Chayav ha'adam lomar bishvili nivra ha'olam, it says in Mishnah Sanhedrin. A person is obligated to say, the world was created for me. Rav Kook now, Gdula anavatanit zu me'asheret hi et adam. This great humility, right? Do you hear the poetry here? This is humility to say that the whole world is created for me, because you're seeing your place in the role of things. You know, it's not like a false humility; it's true. Moses, who is considered the most humble, was also the most cosmic. And he understood that, you know, his role in history. This great level of humility, zu me'asheret hi et adam, this brings osher to a human being. Osher is happiness with an aleph, when you're happy, when you're in touch with the unity. Ayin is wealth, and the numerical value of ayin is 70. And it's multiplicity, the 70 nations of the world, and so on. So it's numbers, right? You know, it fits. It's like the plurality is connoted by 70 nations of the world, etc. But happiness, richness comes from much. Happiness comes from connection to the osher, from with the one. This great humility brings osher to the person. Umeviyato leshlemut ha'elyona, and brings the person to their highest completion, highest fulfillment. You know, this is very holism. You come to your shlemut. Ha'omedet v'mechakelo, that is standing there and waiting for you. It's waiting for you to step into you. Your highest being is waiting for you to step into it. And when you are marching and walking in this confident path of life, the maslulo hameyuchad, in your unique maslul, path, and it's interesting, the word maslul has the same letters as the word sulam. Mm-hmm. So a maslul is a sulam, but a ladder, mm-hmm, as it were going up. Be'orach tzadikim hameyuchad shelo, in the righteous path that is uniquely yours. Okay, orach tzadikim is often translated, you know, it's a phrase from the tradition. You know, the path of the righteous. You've got to do the path, means you do the path that the righteous people do. And, you know, you daven like they do, you do this like they do. That also means in tzedakah, real things. But it's still like you're following a path of a tzaddik. But here he's saying, no, what it really means is your tzaddik path. The path of your tzaddik is what you need to find and walk. And in your unique path, Orach Tzadikim, Yimaleh Gvurat Chaim V'Arizut Ruchanit, you will be filled with strength of life and spiritual enthusiasm and vitality. The Or Hashem Allah Yigaleh, and then the light of God will be revealed upon you. Meha'ot ha-meyuchad shelcha shelo ba-Torah, from your unique letter of the Torah. So, right, everybody gets the reference here. It's a beautiful. There is a teaching in the tradition that 600,000 and so letters in the Torah. We can count them now easily, and so they correspond. I don't think the number is an exact number, but it's similar to the 600,000 souls that left Egypt. And we have the teaching that we are all, you know, expansions of those 600. I mean, it's not fair because there was 3 million people. The 600,000, it doesn't. It was the men between 20 and 60 that they called the 600,000. Leaving all that aside, the people in Egypt are considered the root souls, as it were, that we're all continuations of. But he's saying it, each one of us, the Hasidic rabbis. This is where Rav Kook is doing Hasidut. The Hasidic rabbis would talk about this, that, you know, each one of us has our letter of the Torah and so on. And here he's saying that's, we have to find our letter of the Torah is that letter which we write, which we carve out through our unique path, which we do that no one else has done. No one else can do. It's from our unique letter of the Torah, Yetzelo Uzo Ve'oro, will come forth for you, your strength and your light. And so I bless us that each one of us will, you know, that if we take this to heart, what does this mean individually and collectively? It's that each one of us is here to do something that only we can uniquely do. And if we want to be happy in our lifetime, we need to honor it and give it expression. Otherwise, we'll be living false lives. Mm-hmm. You know, what's this existential term, the Sartre term for living a false life? In terms of Tel Aviv brings out all these other references. It's fun. But, right, that sort of false, there's a word for it that the existentialists have for false living, where you're not really being true to who you are.
Inauthentic, perhaps?
That's also.
Yeah. Okay.
So if we're to say about Rav Kook here in terms of Jewish, this is encouraging because it says being, you want to get close to God, it's not about mimicking the other person's religiosity and mimicking a religiosity form, but it's really, really about honoring who your soul really is and really your being and doing that. And that's... may we be blessed for each of us to do that.
It's easy not to.
And it's very easy not to. The whole world is designed to give us, you know, make choices attractive and to, you know, seduce us into all sorts of other directions and direct us, and, you know, just the entire world where most of the time people are filling themselves, you know, with stuff from the outside doesn't give room. And that actually connects to the next piece. Let's just keep going. This is in Notebook Gimel, the notebook before that, where he says like this: Hapnimiyut ha'atzmutit shel haneshama, the essential inner being of the soul, the atzmiyut apnimiyut, your essential inner being, ha'hoge, that is like thinking, that is higayon, has thoughts, that has got consciousness, achaya et achaim aruchanim amitim, that is living the true spiritual life, that part of us which is our spirit. Hitzricha, and here there's a typo. The first letter can be crossed out. Hitzricha cherut muchlata pnimit, needs complete inner freedom. Okay, so you don't have too many rabbis speaking in this. The inner aspect of the soul requires complete inner freedom. So what is inner freedom? How do we know if our soul is free? וחירותה שהיא חייה, its liberation, which is its life, its energy, באה לה מתוך מחשבתה המקורית, comes to the soul from its original thought, from thinking מחשבה for oneself, thinking your own original thought, שזהו הזיק הפנימי שלה, that this is its inner spark, המתלווה, מתלווה, והולך על ידי הלימוד והעיון, that is inflamed and develops through study and investigation. Right? You read books, you learn halakha, you do all that, and that, you know, it does inflame your inner being. Aval hazik ha'atzmi hu yesod ha'rayon v'machshava, but it's your inner spark, your essential spark. That's the foundation of thought and understanding. Not what the outside is saying. Ve'im lo yutan lazik ha'atzmi makom lehofia be'oro. And if you do not give room for your essential spark to manifest in its light, as kol ma shebalo min achutz lo yo'il, then everything that you get from the outside will be of no value. Hazik muchrach, you'll be living a false life. Even with your fill your head with a zillion PhDs and so on. Hazik muchrach lehishtamer betaharato. This spark needs to be guarded, shomer, in its purity. Vehamachshava hapninit, and the inner thought. Beomek haemet shela, in its depth of its truth. Begodla v'siguva, in its hugeness and exaltation. Muchrechet hi li'it orer, that has to be awakened. Our inner thinking has to be awakened. We have to be thinking our own original thoughts. Not just, where do I fit into the panoply of how people think? Am I a labor Zionist? Am I this? Am I a that? Am I a this? That's all from the outside. What is our soul telling us? What is your soul telling you? And it's to be able to make that space for that experience of our inner thinking, our inner understanding. That's important. How important is it? That we have to, this inner thought has to be awakened. Lo yikabe zik chodesh, you should not quench, put out the fire with this holy light, spark, mipnei shum talmud v'shum iyun, because of any study or any investigation. You should never say, oh, so that's what it is. Or, you know, never think that you've got it and that, you know, well, just, and so on. I mean, there's lots of ways of explaining what he might mean by that. But it's, the point is, that inner spark is our spirit. Is the spirit part of our being, and that's the part that, you know, of interest to God and to ourselves. Life is much more interesting when one is living in one's own being and living in harmony with one's deepest aspirations and interests and creativity and so forth. And now the final line, Hayichud hapnimi shel haneshama, the inner unification, the inner uniqueness of the soul, betochiyut atzma, in its very essential being, zehu, this is hagodel ha'elyon, this is the great, huge greatness of what? Shel zera ha'ora Elohi, of the seed of godly light, divine light, Or Zarua Letzadik, from, I don't know if that's a pasuk or from the it's a pasuk, it's Tehillim or something. Or Zarua Letzadik, the light planted for the righteous. And here Rav Kook, using the words of Yeshayahu, expands it. Asher Mimenu Yatzitz Uferach, it is from the inner being of the soul, from it will blossom and flower, and that's from Yeshayahu 27:6. Pri Eitz Chaim, the fruit of the tree of life. And that's Rav Kook. And isn't that a beautiful image? We are here, all of us affected by having ingested the consciousness of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and we're all in this experience of good, evil, like this, like that. We're in this uncertainty, safek, all of that that is represented by that metaphor that we are consciousness of good and evil. And our work is to correct that, and the punchline is by doing good. It's morality is the answer. And but then what happens is we get access to the tree of life. Mm-hmm. Because it says in the Torah that when we left the garden, the angels were there to protect the tree of life. The protected tree of life is that it's there when we're ready to eat of it. And Rav Kook says the way to that tree of life, it's not a tree out there. It's the fruit of the tree of life is our deep unification with our inner being, which is what the godly light is. That's where the godly light is experienced. When we do that, then we will truly flower and blossom our branch of the tree of life, our leaves of the tree of life. Each one of us, as we sprout our being, our most beautiful full being, that's how the tree of life gets grown, and that's our challenge, and it's such a gift, because here's God saying, I mean, Rav Shlomo Zal and all the Hasidim will always say, which Rebbe was it? I'm trying to remember. Says it's a famous Hasidic one of the Rebbe said, you know, God's not going to, Zusha, I think, God's gonna ask, not going to ask me, hey Zushala, why weren't you like Moshe Rabbeinu? He's going to ask you, Zushala, why weren't you Zushala? That's what Shlomo would say. But that's the teaching. We're going to get asked, not why weren't you like someone else, why weren't you who you really are? And that's the fruit of the tree of life. Amen, v'amen. Thank you for letting me share that. And so these are good pieces. I assume you can see why I'm enthusiastic about the teachings of Rav Kook.
Absolutely.
And I'll tell you my introduction to it. These pieces, like these two pieces, were actually so. And then we'll go to the next. The first time I met the name Rav Kook was somebody. I got my whole life story is in a nutshell that my father's family were Klausenberg Hasidim in Europe. But because of the Holocaust and all that stuff, that thing got all shattered. My parents came to Israel post-Holocaust. My mother was in Auschwitz. My father was in labor camp. Most of his family was killed in Auschwitz. It was the Eichmann in 1944 in Transylvania. That's where my parents were, and they survived. They met when they came back right afterwards, and everybody was partnering up because everybody's family was gone. And they had their wedding day. It didn't make it in the papers because it was the day Hiroshima was dropped. That was their wedding day, so I always remember the anniversary. And then in 48, my father was a Beitarnik and a Jabotinskyite. He would help him. And so they came to Israel through Cyprus and came to Israel in 48, and then I was born here in 1951. And then my parents moved to Canada when I was 8 years old, and then I came back here in my 20s and got serious about Torah study. And a number of years later, I was teaching Jewish high school in Winnipeg. And as I recently read the thing, and my wife, ex-wife, bless her, I think it's one of these, she gave me this book when it was with the cover and everything, by Abraham Isaac Cook, by Ben Sion Boxer. I really recommend it. There's two volumes of his translations out. One, this one of the essential writings of Rav Kook. And it's excellent. So get them both, and you'll have stuff to read for a long time. We'll be getting good chunk of photocopying from this one next week. And my story was that I was teaching Jewish high school, and you know, I was looking for, I was interested in trying to find the, you know, a large Torah. I was a universalist who had sort of put myself deep into spirituality. And I sat down one day in Winnipeg Beach and started to read from this very same book. And I started to read something in the, or it was in this, the early part of the book, so it must be from Orot HaTshuva. I started to read, and I had like a spiritual experience. I mean, I felt my whole consciousness expand. And no, natural, just nothing. Completely expand, and it was like, oh! There was this huge spaciousness of thought that was like, wow, we can think this large. And so I started reading, I started reading with Sharon, and we started reading with our adult friends, and then I started doing it with my high school students. And at a part of a retreat we did, and they really liked it. And we would sit around once a week with this very same book, everybody bought a copy, and we would just read together in English. And these 17, 18-year-old, hip Winnipeg, North End, there was the South End, but the school was in the North End. They really, so I would, this went on for a few years. And, so that was my beginning in learning Rav Kook. And these sort of pieces were the ones we were reading, and they were saying, like, wow! I remember the first time I did it, one of them said, wow, this is better than drugs! and I just continued reading. I made the transition to his Hebrew along the way, and then his poetry. But thank you for that. All right, so this is the pieces about Shirat Nafsho. The second frame, which I found very helpful, is Rav Kook had a number of students. The first student to find him was already when he came in 1904. His name is Rav Charlap from Jerusalem, and he was the rabbi of Shari Tzedek, or Shari Chesed neighborhood, in that from a revered rabbinic family, a young man, and he came. And because he wasn't feeling well, they said, go to the country, go to the ocean. It was Shavuot. He came to daven at Rav Kook's synagogue. Rav Kook had just arrived a few weeks before then. And he describes, this was one of the revered rabbinic families of Jerusalem. He heard him pray, the Akdamot, which is something, the special prayers of Shavuot. And he says, my soul cleaved to him from that point, and he became his first student and chaver. It was like a Talmid Chaver, Rav Charlap. Aryeh Levin, the Tzaddik of Yerushalayim, also connected with Rav Kook in those years and took him on as his Rebbe. And then Rav Kook was in Switzerland in 1914. And there was another person whose name was Rabbi David Cohen, a Cohen. Connected, he lived in the area around where the Chafetz Chaim, and his family was sort of connected to the Chafetz Chaim, who was also a Kohen, and was a great Talmid Chacham, and also was a Renaissance figure in many ways, and really wanted to study the world, and he went to go to university and studied philosophy, and was getting philosophy. He was a student of Hermann Cohen, the neo-Kantian, Jewish neo-Kantian philosopher in Germany at that time, was the leading of the philosopher of the world, and he describes that he heard that Rav Kook was, this is before he meets Rav Kook, but he's also deeply interested in mysticism, and when he's deported from Germany, when the First World War breaks out, because he's also a Russian citizen, he's deported from Germany. They spent some time in a DP camp somewhere in Germany, and he meets a certain Mekubal, whose name is recorded, and they spent a few weeks together there. And out of that experience, it deepens his connection with Kabbalah, and he also begins the practice of being a Nazir. And a Nazir being, you take on the practice. He didn't do it as a vow, because we don't do vows, but as a practice, not to cut his hair, not to drink wine. He also took on vegetarianism and not wearing leather as part of an expansion of that. And he describes in his book, which is the first volume of The Lights of Holiness, I heard Rav Kook was in Switzerland. I wrote asking, can I come and see you? And he said, yes. So I came. I took a mikvah in the River Rhine, carrying a book of Kabbalah, Shari Tshuva, I think. I came to Rav Kook's house. He spent the evening in where he was staying in Switzerland, talking about philosophy. It was interesting, but not earth-shaking. But at night, we went to sleep. In the morning, I awoke and I heard above me the sounds of footsteps and the sound of prayer. Rav Kook was in the room above him. He says, I went outside to the door upstairs there, and I listened. And Rav Kook was davening in the early part of Pesukei Dezirma. We have the Akedat Yitzchak, the sacrifice of Yitzchak. He was doing it in Tam Nigun Elyon, which is a particular tam that's used on special notes of the Torah, that's used especially on only certain occasions. But that was how he prayed it. The Nazir says, "V'hikshafti v'nehefachti b'yot ish acher." I was transformed. I listened, and I was transformed, becoming a different person. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, he says, Rav Kook was my Rebbe, and he goes on to study. He stays in Switzerland, studies. 1922, Rav Kook asks him to come to Jerusalem to help him write the curriculum for the yeshiva and to teach at his yeshiva. He doesn't finish his PhD, and he comes to be with Rav Kook. This is what he looked like. And Rabbi David Cohen, the first hippie of the 20th century.
This is look like a freak.
Yeah. Right?
Was he married?
He was. Yes, he was. The Shariash was. He's his, yes, he was.
So his marriage was intact?
It was very interesting. He was betrothed at this time. His wife was getting her agricultural studies in another piece of Lithuania because their plan was to go in Israel and set up work in a thing. She was doing agricultural studies. The First World War broke out. He couldn't go to see her for many years, though they stayed loyal. 1920, he comes to Jerusalem. A short time after that, I think a year or two later, Rav Kook brings her to Jerusalem. She shows up in Jerusalem, they're finally going to, but he's completely different. Part of his thing was he didn't speak on Shabbat, and the 40 days from Rosh Chodesh Elul to the end of Yom Kippur, the 40 days that Moses was up in Har Sinai. So we talk about practices of that. He was a serious practitioner.
Sure.
But his wife comes, and he had
to... She wanted someone to talk to.
Exactly. And because it was the time he was usually in his silence, they brought the great rabbis of Jerusalem. They released him of the practice, of the commitment to it, to that. And then the eyewitness, or an ear witness, records, she shows up, she comes to see him on Shabbat. He had been sleeping at Merkaz Arava most of the nights at that time. He was there 24/7, and the benches there. He was late, it was Shabbat, and the person describing it was in the next room. They brought in food and drink for them to have together to meet each other. And this is what he says. He heard, and then her voice, "I'm not going to eat until you talk." Yes, yes. Talking so she eats, right? And then 2 minutes later, "I'm not going to drink until you talk." Shti. You know, that's the thing. And then, you know, so they meet. She leaves a little bit on things. She goes to speak with Rav Kook.
Wait, is that the end of the story?
No. So she goes and speaks with Rav Kook. Says, "I mean, this isn't the person." He says, "You know what? Don't worry. I know he really loves you. It'll be great. We'll do the wedding here." Rav Kook was in the Seder Kedushin as well as the father and mother with his wife. They did the wedding in Beit HaRav, and they lived happily ever after. She was the main vegetarian cook of Jerusalem. Their house, which I'll show you when you come to Jerusalem, was overflowing with flowers and gardens because she was very much growing. Every morning he would water all that, their apartment. And he was an extraordinary mystic of Jerusalem. He passed away in 1972. This is what he looked like.
But did he ever stop with the vows of not talking?
No, he only didn't talk on Shabbat and the 40 days from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur.
And it didn't help that they told him he didn't have to do that.
He talked to her a little bit that, but then she understood his spirituality and his family honored him.
Did he have children?
He had two children.
His daughter married Rav Gorin. His daughter, he's the father-in-law. Talk about it. He's the father-in-law of Shlomo Gorin.
Whoa.
He is his father. His son is Shaul Yashiv Cohen, the chief rabbi of Haifa, who's sort of my Rebbe in Israel these days. He's been helpful to me.
His son
is Rav Shaul Yashiv Cohen, the chief, retired chief rabbi of Jerusalem. Of Haifa, sorry, not Jerusalem, Haifa. He was the first rabbi in the Israeli Air Force. His son-in-law was Rabbi Shlomo Gorin, who was the rabbi of Tzahal and then the chief rabbi of Israel. And so he didn't talk much, but boy was he involved. He was the first person they brought in 1967 to the Kotel. Shlomo Gorin sent a jeep for him. He hadn't left his house for years by that point. And they brought a jeep. Rav Gorin.
Rav Gorin hasn't left his house?
No, Rav Gorin was the chief rabbi of the army.
Right.
He commandeered a jeep to bring him to the Kotel the moment they got to the Kotel.
Right.
It was his father-in-law.
What a story.
Yeah. So what happens was, he shows up in Jerusalem to be with Rav Kook 1922. He describes that from then on I just spent my time with him, and Rav Kook made a request, you can do whatever you want, meditate, silence, you know, everything. But let's spend a few minutes every day in Hitva Adut. Just a few minutes together each day, which says something, but Rav Kook said that. And that was the Nazir's job for the rest of his life, to be around there and every few, whatever was Rav Kook, to be with him when he wanted to, and he wrote the curriculum for the yeshiva. And you have to see this curriculum. It's like so advanced. It's like talking about a universal curriculum, and it didn't quite translate to Merkaz HaRav fully. But that was the idea.
When you mean universal, it was philosophy and faith, but not necessarily taken from Jewish philosophy?
I have to look at it specifically, but all the main big hits of Jewish philosophy are in there, and I have to... But he had mastery of it all. He knew all, could speak in different languages and so on. Anyway, so he describes that one day, after a few years of being a Beit HaRav, I came up to Rav Kook and I said, Rebbe, yesh po kedusha, ruach hakodesh. There's certainly sanctification here with you, ruach hakodesh. Ha'im yesh shita, tochen limudim mesuyam. Is there also like a methodology, a certain content of study? Rav Kook says to him, yeah, for sure. And he hands him these 8 notebooks that Rav Kook was writing from 1904 till 1919. And then from 1924 until 1935, the Nazir went through these notebooks and put them out. Finally, these are the volumes of Orot HaKodesh that Rav Kook saw the galleys of the first 2 volumes, and then they were published on the first Yort site in 1936, and then 2 more volumes came out subsequently. And they were what the Nazir, his main student, drew from his notebooks and put them according to a thematic scheme. And I want to share with you that thematic scheme. And basically, in the introduction, he says, to understand Rav Kook, there are 5 root principles. We're going to go through them. I'll go through them very quickly now, and we won't really have time, but the next pieces of the study is from the first one of these 5 principles. So we're going to, each week, since we will do 2 of them, we'll go through them that way. So we'll get the 5 principles as part of our learning. But they are HaKodesh HaKlali, that everything is holy. 2 HaChayut HaOlamit. Everything has chayut. Everything is alive. Actually, we might open from there. Is there a breeze now? Everything, talking about everything being alive. Everything, chayut HaOlamit, everything is alive.
Inanimate.
Right? It's also alive. Physics is telling us all this.
Yes.
3 HaAchdut HaKolelet. The overriding, everything is one. This is Shema Yisrael, Shemavirshah, and Chaz. The overriding oneness of all. 4 HaTov HaKlali, universal, overall, good. The entire creation is a creation of good.
It's here, of course, she addresses, well, easy to say, what about bad? And we'll address that when we get to it. The fifth is Hita'alut Olam, Ha'olam, the elevation of the world. The world is constant process of Hita'alut, elevation, constant process of progress towards the completion that we were seeing in the fourfold song. And it's in here that he wrote, and we'll look at that piece later, but just a thing now, when in those same notebooks he wrote, evolution, right, which, you know, in the world they were freaking out, there's the Stokes trial, all that stuff was coming up. Evolution, which is gaining acceptance in the world, is the secular science closest in harmony to Kabbalah. That's what he wrote in the early 1900s. Evolution is the secular science closest in harmony to Kabbalah because it speaks about that we're in a process of evolution. We're in a process of elevation. Same letters, elevate in present, using that word. But that we're in this process, and the fact that they can see it in one small aspect of the creation is a sign for us that that's the same dynamic going on in all the levels of creation. And so on and so forth. And those are the five. Everything is holy, everything is alive, everything is one, everything is good, everything is in the process of elevation. You can imagine if you were truly able to integrate that consciousness, then it's, you know, enlightenment of sorts. And I had the pleasure of asking his son. I got his son, Shayashiv Cohen, who I'll tell you more about later. What was it like around Rav Kook? Because he was 8 years old when Rav Kook passed away. He was like, grew up, Rav Kook was like his grandfather. Mm-hmm. Every Thursday, Friday, the Nazir would bring his son, you know, and they would play violin Motzei Shabbat for Rav Kook. The Nazir insisted his children learn musical instruments, and they played Motzei Shabbat for Rav Kook. And asked him, so what was it like around Rav Kook? Ragua. Calm. It so struck me that I was thinking, calm. So when I'm thinking about it, what does that mean? He's just in this state of being. That just Ragua. He was in his, and they speak about the inner ego. The Edenic experience. The Dikim are in their Eden to me. And Ragua was in that state. And so he was able to share it. What I'd like to do to complete this, I see we have like 3 minutes, and also I'm happy to go out afterwards, and I just got to tell you if you want to go have coffee and continue the discussion. I hear there's, you have coffee shops in Tel Aviv that are open late, no? I would like to take us through this reading of this the last piece of this as a... let's see if I can actually find. If you will. You know what? Here. This one I have the English for here, but I'll give it to you now. The very last piece. There. Okay, you see where it says Kriya Lehistaklut El Yonah? The last page. The last entry. And that name was given by the Rav HaNazir, who I guess will join us.
Where is it?
Okay. Im tirtze, ben adam, if you will it, human being, and ben adam is sort of like in Sefer Yecheskel, we use that phrase here, ben adam, as he's getting this prophecy. Im tirtze, ben adam, hisakel be'or hashchina, bekol hayekum, look at the light of the divine presence in all existence, yakum, everything that kayam, everything that exists. Histakel be'eden
ha'chaim ha'shmenim. Look upon the harmony, the Eden of the heavenly life. Echem mitpalshim bekol pina v'zavit shebechaim. How they spread into every corner and aspect of life. Haruchim ruchanim v'chomerim, that are spiritual and material. Sheneged einei besarecha v'neged einei ruchecha, that are before your eyes of flesh and are before your eyes of spirit. Gaze upon the light of the divine presence in all existence. Hitbonen beplayei ha-yetzira. Reflect, bina, think deeply about the wonders of creation, the chayei ha-elut shelahem, the divine dominion of their being, in their godly life. Lo betor eze tochnit keheh, not in some sort of dim, dark idea, vision or plan, or shememerchakim matzidim negedinecha, that is from the distant being presented before your eyes. It's not far away. Ki im da et hametziut she'ata chayba, but no, this is the reality that you're living in. We're living in the plaei ha-yetzira, the wonders of creation. Da et atzmecha ve'et olamcha. Da et hegyone ha-lev shelcha. Know yourself, your world, the thoughts of your heart, the promptings of your being. Ve'shelkol hogev ve'choshev, and of every thinker and reflector, matze et mekor ha-chaim shebekirbecha, find the source of life that is within you, u'shememe'al lecha, which is beyond you, shemasvavecha, mislavicha, which is all around you, et pe'erei hadrot ha-chaim sha'ata sharui betucham, the splendor, the glory of life that you are immersed in. We're sharui, we're basting in. We're sharui, is that the word for basting? Right? We're basting in this pe'erei hadrot ha-chaim, splendor, glorious life. Ahahava shebekirbecha, the love that is within you, he'ele ota leshorosh uzad v'eznat tifarta, raise it to the source of its strength and its glorious Edenic beauty. Herchiva l'chol sarafoteha, expand it, broaden it to all its branches, l'chol eshed nishmat chayei olamin, to every branch of the soul of the life of the universe. Asher rak ritzutz ha-makom shel ha-hogeh. It's only the narrow comprehension of the thinker, gorem mi'ut zaharo, causes a lacking of its light. Right? There's a huge universal life and light and love, ahava, that bring it forth and take it to all aspects of life. And the only reason we're not seeing all aspects of life is because we're in a narrow state of consciousness. Ritzutz. Hedet al ha'orot betochiyutam. Look at the lights in their inwardness. Al yivla'u nishmatecha ha'shemot ha'nivim v'ha'otiyot. Don't confine your soul by the names, the idioms, the letters. Right? Don't swallow your soul into your I'm a communist, I'm a this. You're a word, you're like a category. Hey, these words, language, are given to you. You're not given over to them. We're not here to be defined by concepts. We're here to use them to explain things, but that's not to be limited by a concept. Ale lemala ale, ki koach oz v'cha. Rise, high, rise. You have a powerful strength. Yesh lecha knafei ruach, knafei nisharim avirim. You have wings of spirit, wings of mighty eagles. Al tikachesh pam, bam pen yikachashu lecha. Do not deny them,
lest they deny you. Drashotam, ulecha miyad, seek for them, and you'll find them immediately. And now you see this next one has a capital letter there, Yikarim. That means the Nazir took this piece and appended it to here. It's from another place in the diary to make this whole thought. In this particular case, this two things is actually found in the diary immediately before this piece. But the Nazir, for the continuation of the thought and the clarity, chose to put it at the end. So just so that that's how you read, so to understand why that's like that. Yikarim v'ktoshim heilanim levushei hetziyurim. Precious and holy are the garments of these images. Muchachim heilanim. We need the garments, the names, and so on. L'chol balei gvul b'mabatem ha'uchanim b'yichud. And especially to people that are limited in their spiritual outlook. We need all of this. Aval tamid ve'et she'anu ba'im le'cha'im mada'im, but always when we are seeking, coming to a life of understanding, asur lanu lazuz mi'hanekuda ha'elyona, it is forbidden for us to move from this highest point, which is she'rak mi'habilti nitfas, or mi'halesh be'hanitfas. It's only from the ungraspable that light comes forth to the graspable. From the infinite comes the finite. So the root of everything is in the infinite. B'mahalach ha'atzilut, this is the process of emanation, mi'or ein sof, from the source of, from the infinite light. Ve'anu, and we. Right, and please notice in this one, there's nothing here that's Jewish. It starts, Im tirtzeh ben adam. This is for every human being. Anu kru'im, we are called, liyot mit'adnim ba'adanim hashmemim, to be Edenized in the heavenly Edens. B'chol pratei hakarot, in all the particularized understandings, Shebeklal hagadol hazeh, that are in this universal whole, shemimenu tozaot kol hachaim, that from it has emerged all life. We are called to be Edenized in the heavenly Edens. We have wings of mighty eagles. Let's not deny them, lest they deny us. Let each of us seek our own wings, and they're immediately ready for us. Ale lemala ale, ki koach az lecha, yesh lecha, lach, lachem, lekulanu, knafei ruach, knafei nesharim avirim. Al tichachesh pam, hem yikachshu lecha, drash otam, ve'imtzeu lecha lanu miyad. Chaim, תודה רבה.